Strzelecki Institute closed in protest when the war began. So beginning anew, we focused again on this question of computation and the role of computation as a planetary technology, both in terms of what it can do, but also the ways in which computational infrastructures allow us to understand the world in ways in which would otherwise be impossible. That's the program I currently direct called Antikythera. It is, this is from our website, you can go to thera.org. It is named, as you suspect, after the Antikythera mechanism, the proverbial first computer. From ancient Greece, one of the things we liked about this was that the Antikythera mechanism was not just a calculative device, it was also an astronomical device. And so the use of the device was a way in which intelligence was able to orient itself in relationship to its planetary condition. This is a lovely beginning point for really what computation should mean. Now, to the forward, we also start with what does computation have to do with climate change? Well, let's not forget, the very idea of climate change itself is an epistemological accomplishment of planetary computation. Without the satellites and sensors, and most importantly, supercomputing simulations of climatic past, present, and futures, the notion of climate change and anthropocene as we know it. So, our program is a design program. It's also a philosophy of technology program, which is a bit odd in that sense. That is, we don't start with the philosophy and then try to project it upon the technology, rather the other way around. We start with the direct encounter with the technology and generate the philosophy from there. Our five areas of research, I won't go through these in too much detail, roughly AI, recursive simulations, a hemispheric attack, which is computational geopolitics, synthetic catalysis of economics and planetary safety, which I will say a little bit about, which has to do with the location of computational intelligence in the longer arc of the evolution of planetary intelligence as such. A little bit about our method. Again, it's faculty from all over the world, from our finance institutions. We did a five-month studio this summer, starting in February, where Brazilian applicants, to 12 people, built the studio primarily based at the Bradbury Building, downtown LA, where Blade Runner was shot, very, very dramatic. And we basically, it was a sort of 24/7 kind of studio, very interdisciplinary, very generative, cycling between seminar and studio types of formats extremely quickly. There's our friend Nicholas giving his thumbs up to the work. We also generated a huge number of projects, some of which I'll show you stills from the films very quickly here as well. One of which we did, which was very fun, we were interested in the computational, geopolitical futures of computation, US-China chip wars kinds of things. We went to Beijing, we're based at the Bergeron Institute, which is our primary funder, has a center at Beida, Peking University. For a week, we worked with some of the top Chinese science fiction writers to develop scenarios for how it is that these futures may play out, which was going to be a book, actually, from MIT Press coming out as well. On climate, we did a project called Whole Earth Codec, which was looking at the development of a strongly multimodal compression-decompression codec that would take in ecological information from a number of different sources and can output them in a number of different ways. And these are stills from the rather lovely video about this, all, of course, based on this sort of the self-attention dynamic of transformer models. This is the project we'll continue with DeepMind this summer. Project on simulations, planetary simulations. Of course, climate science is all about simulations. Here we're looking at the phenomenon of what we call counter simulations, how it is that one geopolitical entity will not only simulate the world, but also simulate its adversary. Counter simulations is when you, in essence, spoil the data in some sort of way in which the adversary's counter simulation, the simulation of you, doesn't quite work out. And it is this dynamic of simulation, counter simulation that became the whole area of the research. That we did. It's a fascinating film. On economics, we did a project called Autocatalaxy, which was looking at the impact of AI will have on price. What kinds of things need to be priced, don't need to be priced, how it is the price functions as an information technology, and the capacities of AI to sense and model information in different kinds of ways will have different, obviously, tumultuous effects. On AI, one we call HAID, Human AI Interaction Design, is looking at the shift from HCI to HAI-ID. And the primary shift here is whether the HCI is based on spatial metaphors, HAI-ID is based on psychosocial metaphors. This is a fundamental shift in dynamics. I had lovely conversations with new friends over at the Lab this afternoon on very similar work they were doing. On science, we did two projects, one called End of Science, which is looking at the impacts of AI on scientific epistemology and some of the ways in which new kinds of epistemic overhangs and underhangs have developed. On regionalization, also kind of connected to the Half-Earth, the impact of the ways in which a kind of regional planning school has developed around building of the stack. We looked at the TSMC's plants in Arizona. Xenoplex is a cinematic essay on different theories of abiogenesis, which we did with a number of astrobiologists and astrophysicists, looking at different kind of experimental methods by which these could be tested. And then lastly, Vivarium is another simulation and AI project looking at toy worlds and the ways in which AIs are trained in toy worlds and the ways in which the sim to real gap might be blended in different ways. What we built is essentially a platform of lots of different toy worlds that are interoperable with one another. And so as you train your AI in one, this becomes learning in another and allows for a kind of matrix of one person, many AIs, one person, many people, many AIs, in different ways as well. This is, again, one we're picking up with DeepMind. We also, as you surmise, make lots of films. These are really scenarios. They're not pitches. And in doing so, we use the cinematic techniques as a way of kind of building these worlds. We also do a lecture series, which we also build in films. This is a talk I gave in London just a couple months ago on sort of a critique of the idea of AI alignment, which is posted. I'm happy to show you. And if you speak to me afterwards, so anyway, this is what we did in the first 5 months. What I've just shown you is sort of our first five months of the program. Doing considerably more next year. We've just published a big 600-page report. I'll be happy to give you the URL to download it a bit later if you want. Next year, we are doing a lot of work with USC, Tsinghua, DeepMind Cambridge, as mentioned, and as you see here on the planetary sapience theme, we'll be back here in Cambridge in the fall working on this with a number of groups here. Let me leave you with one thought, because I think I'm at the end of my time. As I said, we think of this program as a philosophy of technology program that uses design studio methodologies as a way of developing scenarios, or it's a speculative design program that happens to be driven by a rather specific philosophical agenda. It's really both at once. But the real idea is this, is that, and I strongly believe this, there are certain points and times in history where our ideas about what might be possible and what it is that we like to do are ahead of our technologies. And so 19th century dreams of space flight might be an example. There are other points in history, however, where our technologies and what they're capable of doing is ahead of our ideas. It's ahead of our concepts. It's ahead of our ability to articulate and to adjudicate and to make sense of them. That's where I think we are at now. And in that point in time, the role of philosophy of technology is rather different. It's not about projecting things onto the technology. What would Hegel think of driverless cars? It's a rather the other way around. How do we generate the concepts that we need to be oriented? Or into cemetery consultation, and not only be wanted to buy it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Benjamin. That was intense. I learned a great deal, so very inspiring. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, who is Janelle Knox-Hayes. Janelle Knox-Hayes is a professor of economic geography and planning in the MIT Department of Urban Studies and Planning. Her research focuses on the ways in which social and environmental systems are governed under changing temporal and spatial scales as a consequence of globalization. Please welcome Janelle to the stage.
I'm not technically a designer, I'll just give that caveat, but very pleased to be able to join this distinguished group. And I'm a social scientist. I'm going to talk a little bit around social science and social application for climate change. And I really would just want to highlight one of the things that we've recently done at MIT. And so it's this idea of one of the ways in which we need more equitable response to climate solutions is the engagement of a range of different stakeholders. And so this is something like institutions like MIT do very well in different sectors, but very segmented. So we have a range of different climate-related institutions, the Environmental Thinking Initiative, the MIT Climate and Sustainability Consortium, GRAWOC, JPL, even maybe the Morningside Academy could be considered as one of these new institutions that's thinking about for climate change. and they tend to be focused on very different sectors. Unity is working with corporations. We have groups like CoLab that are very much focused on communities. And so our hypothesis is what we need for climate change is some capacity to bring all of these together. The solutions have to begin from the standpoint of local intervention, local action, and they have to bridge this divide between communities, academia, the government, and industry, and bring all of the players together. So the way we're trying to do this at MIT is by building something akin to a climate community collaborative. And so to start or launch this initiative, we hosted a symposium recently in September. And I want to overview what happened at the symposium, how we're carrying forward, and the kind of impact that that might generate. So this brought together stakeholders from across the greater Boston area. And again, there's this challenge of scale. For the sake of the launch of this symposium, we decided to focus on 14 municipalities in Boston. And it's by no way saying that that's the only thing that matters or we can do this in isolation. It was just creating a kind of scope that makes a partnership or a collaboration possible with the idea that in time this can create a model that other cities can replicate or that can extend to other areas and draw other actors in. And it's trying to bridge an advanced interdisciplinary approach to working in a fashion that's more equitable, just, and effective for climate solutions. So the idea of this collaborative is to form a kind of knowledge sharing among the various types of climate experts, academic, operations experts, industry, policy, and community-based. And we use this symposium to bring them together and to begin to define the collaborative. So I'll explain a little bit about our agenda and how we did this. We also think it's an opportunity for initial listening and dialogue via exploration of what's already happening in the greater Boston area and how academic institutions in particular can work together to catalyze that. So within this group, we had a kind of spontaneous breakout session that led to the call for a larger convening of tribes in the Northeast. And I think this is something MIT is interested to explore, how indigenous and academic collaboration can more effectively tackle equitable climate actions and benefit all communities. It's something Harvard has also been considering. They held a responsibility and repair workshop or symposium and invited the local tribes in to think about the shortcomings and the deficits in that historical relationship and how they can move forward building. So we're looking at all pieces of this. The symposium itself, we reached out to more than 300 individuals. We had 150 or more attend the symposium, and it really drew together a very diverse group of different types of NGOs, different municipal government representatives, different elements of civil society, and then also we had 10 different universities from the region participate and engage. And we had a number of different activities that were meant to really center this workshop on understanding needs for a collaborative, how this would work in a concrete vision within the Boston area, and then capacity. So what you can see kind of in the center of this diagram is one of a mapping exercise we did, where we gathered data of registrants about their needs, what their organizations need to be more effective in their climate interventions within the city, and then the capacities they could bring and coming in. So we organized a series of categories on a large wall, and then we used post-it notes. First, all of the organizations went up and they put out their needs in one color, and then we had them walk the wall and look at what was represented and take a different color post-it and map to it their capacity. So we directly mapped, and now we're mining this data and looking at different ways in which we can start to build relationships within the region. So the overview, we started with kind of understanding a state of affairs within the region. We looked at the state of the state, what is being happening within Massachusetts at the state level. We had Julie Wormser come and present for the Mystic Valley Watershed, which encompasses more than, I think, 10 different municipalities, and she presented a lot of the work they're doing to bridge collaborations across a broader region and sort of thinking outside of the bounds of the municipal action, because one of the things that's happening is all of these municipalities are in the process of doing climate action planning, but there's a lot of challenges around capacity and integration between different municipalities. So how do you build that larger scale? We think this is one of the areas where the academic institutions can be a big support in bridging. And then we had a presentation from the from Jason Steining, the Natural Resource Director for the Wampanoag Tribe, to also think about the non-human in this. It's really going to center
an indigenous approach. And one of the ways they're doing this is to adopt the herring. So they have a legal process right now to adopt herring within their traditional territorial waters. And they think that giving personhood and custody of the herring to the tribe is one way in which they can represent the river system with a better legal standing, so that it's incorporated and considered in legal planning. So we sort of oriented this view of what's happening, and we had one presentation from Eastie Farms thinking about what some of the local communities in more underrepresented areas are doing within the city and where they need elements of support. And so we hosted a session of case studies, where we have 10 or so different case studies, successful collaborations, formed roundtables. We allowed participants to join those roundtables and understand some of the most effective collaborations that are ongoing in the city, and how these can be scaled up and built out. And so as our next phase of sort of building this collaborative, we're actually going to start hosting site visits for the network that formed out of the symposium and these different sites. And we can form partnerships with that. As I mentioned, we did this mapping exercise of our needs and capacities to understand generatively what's required for collaboration to be more successful. And one of the things that the communities really brought forward was this idea, it's prevalent in the scholarship of indigenous authors like Kyle White, the idea that we're tackling climate change as though it were a purely technical solution. So a lot of this is thinking about carbon reduction or net zero targets or building new infrastructure. And to be effective, we have to realize that it's also social. There's also a relational approach that's required. So as we're facing an ecological tipping point for many of these communities that are essential to a just and efficacious response to climate change, there's also a relational tipping point that's already been crossed. Before we can even get to climate, we have to rebuild relationships. And for a lot of the indigenous communities, that's an underlying thread that kind of follows their engagement or their work with these possibilities. And what, you know, beyond the ethics of why this matters, they're still major landholders. We're not going to be able to do land use planning without engaging the indigenous communities. We also looked at the ways in which we can scale funding opportunities, and some of those at the workshop presented very successful models of how they're doing this. This was a part of a presentation by Phil Thompson and Liz Reynolds, who are working with the MIT Nucleus, and they're basically creating programs for grant writers in the classroom and sending them out to underserved communities across the country to help deploy some of the funding that's coming from the IRA and BIL. We looked at the role of higher education, and this is kind of our idea of the heart of the collaborative. And this was thinking about both what a number of different institutions like Hot Tufts and Roxbury Community College, Northeastern, et cetera, are doing in response to climate change, but then also thinking about how we start to build partnerships together, how we synergize these activities, form something of an academic core, and then bring in and bridge the other dimensions across sectors from that standpoint. So our next steps, we sent out a follow-up survey. We've also built a LinkedIn group as one way in which we're starting to connect and build out this, the forming network from this symposium. We have a number of students that are working on analyzing the extensive data that we got from our various sessions, and we're going to generate a report that will come out hopefully early next year that synthesizes all of the information we gathered. We've been holding meetings with both our advisory committee meeting that helped set up the symposium with us, and then we had an external academic group that we are now forming into this academic core. And so we have two sets of site visits that we're organizing to begin to build the community collaborative. One is site visits with the academic team partners to better understand the distribution, operations, needs, resources of each institution. Because as you can imagine, what MIT is doing or what MIT needs is quite different from Roxbury Community College. The type of stakeholders MIT is going to be able to engage is quite different from the stakeholders that Roxbury Community College is going to be able to engage. So kind of understanding and mapping those different relationships is critical to forming a core. And then we're also starting to host to engage the broader symposium participants, site visits to the various case study partners so that we can get a deeper learning, deeper knowledge dive in what's actually happening in the region. And then finally, so you know, again, sort of thinking about this as beginning is this local academic, government, tribal, community, industry partnership and forming a different, catalyzing different activities at different points across the region. we're also highly aware of other types of activities that are forming around this. So there was 2 weeks after we hosted our symposium, the Boston Green Ribbon Commission hosted or was part of a climate beacon project. And rather than seeing these competitive opportunities or competitive projects, we really think there's a strong opportunity for integration. The beacon event, I don't know if anyone here was at that, it's operating at a more macro scale, so bringing in kind of a higher operation. It's also much more industry focused, and so it could be a really nice partner there could be a nice synergistic relationship with a community climate collaborative. All right, so follow-up steps, follow-up recommendations. We're trying to grow the collaborative. We're thinking about how we can operate the collaborative. And then also, you know, for now, this is being hosted in-house and somewhat, you know, in anti-fashion fashion with the other academic institutions. But we're thinking about major grant funding, how we would go out and do this to build something like a secretariat that sits between the institutions and host this activity for the region. So I'd love to talk more about that and hear your ideas and thoughts in the dialogue. Thank you very much. We'll turn it over to you.
Thanks so much. Well, that was such important work that you're doing. And you've queued us up perfectly. So I'm going to introduce Air Muir. Air Muir is the founder of Clover Food Lab, a vegetarian restaurant chain that works with local providers to reduce the CO2 footprint of the food industry. Mm. From the air.
Hi, everybody. Hopefully I have something to contribute here. MIT men and moms, right? Like, some very cerebral topics we're just going through, and I'm going to bring us down to like food that we touch with our hands. I'm the founder of Clover Food Lab, and Clover is, as mentioned, we're a restaurant chain. We're just here in the Boston area, hoping to be many places someday. But right now we operate 15 restaurants in this region. And I'll share something with you. Not everybody knows the name Clover Food Lab, where that comes from. I wanted to call the company Clover, so the idea came up with, and we were at the very beginning facing the problem, which I didn't think this would work. I was trying to figure out how could we make some food that people who love eating meat would dream about and come back for and walk past their favorite, Chipotle or Chick-fil-A or whatever to come eat with us. And I didn't know, I thought it was worth trying, I didn't think it would work. So Clover really started with sort of a design problem, and I think, as any good design approach, I tried to make our test as cheap as possible. That's why we started a food truck here on the MIT campus. And we were afraid at that point, food trucks, is a little history, but sort of interesting, it works around MIT. Carlton Street isn't really a street anymore, but that's where a truck started. It's like right, I don't know if I'm pointing the right direction, but it's like very close to here. And trucks had like a bad reputation at that time. And I wanted to open a restaurant called Clover. What do we call this truck? We don't want to call it the same thing. People might not want to come to the restaurant. That was like the mindset. And I was like, well, we're at MIT. Maybe we call it like the lab that we run for a few months and then open the real restaurant. And we have some name that carries over. And we actually tried to make that transition. We tried to stop using the name Food Lab, and we like changed our website, and I had business cards back then, and like we changed everything to just Clover Fast Food. And 3 years later, I was looking at like Google search results, and like the 60% of the organic search was for Clover Food Lab, not Clover Restaurants or Clover Fast Food. So like somehow that name stuck with people. But I think that people do ask today, who are not familiar with Clover, like why, what's the Food Lab part? And I think, it was a name we chose early on, but symbolically, it's meant to be inclusive. Like you are all the lab, because I think for us, we're trying to design a food system that's going to get us better results, and we need collaboration and cooperation to get there. So really, like everything we're doing well at Clover right now, can be traced back to some customer giving us indirect or direct feedback and, you know, engagement that we've had from a broader community. Get through some of these slides. I think I already talked about that. And this slide is just to make a very simple point, which I think at this point most people here may understand, but I can't say this often enough, because even if we understand our minds, I still don't think this is like lodged itself in people's hearts and worldview. But using animals for food is equivalent in terms of its impact on CO2 emissions, global warming. It's equivalent to the internal combustion engine. And these things are like at the same level, which is a pretty wild idea. And there are actually lots of other impacts that are the result of using animals for food. There's a lot of loss of species, biodiversity, because a lot of our deforestation, most of our deforestation is happening right now is to produce food, and most of that's for cattle grazing and things like that. But it also, erosion, there's lots of other effects. But if you want to just think about climate change, there's this very, very direct impact to the way we choose to eat and the way we choose to fill out our calories and the impact that we're having on the planet. And this is the thing I learned about in 2008 and I found shocking and I was suspicious of, and I like did more research and convinced myself not only probably true, but it's something that like is underinvested in. I think that's true this day. There's a lot of progress, but I still think if we look at the various things that matter to climate change, there's not enough people working on food solutions. So the challenge that I wanted to try, and this isn't the only way to take on, you know, that previous slide, I'm hoping that people have success in lots of different efforts that can help us decarbonize our food system. But the thing I was interested in was, can you make meat-free meals that meat lovers will dream about? And partly, like, this was interesting to me because I really like food a lot. So as I imagine what that future looks like, whatever the design parameters are, I would love it to taste great. You know, I'd like that. I'd like future to be, like, delicious and enjoyable. I don't want it to be, like, punishment eating. So this is what set our path. And I found this old picture, which I thought would be interesting to this group because we're talking about like design and design solutions. So, and as I mentioned, like my belief is you just do the cheapest possible thing you can to get an answer. It's going to let you collect more and better information. And the cheapest thing I could do to explore this idea, I was working at McKinsey & Company at the time, and I had a lot of vacation time because I worked too much. And I took it all at once. So I had like 6 weeks of vacation time all at once. And I went and got a job at Burger King and Panera, but I don't have a picture of the Panera one. And the Burger King uniform is much better too. And I just worked there for 6 weeks to see what, I'd never worked in restaurants before, and I just wanted to see what's it like what's the pace, what's the flow, you know, what are people doing? It was actually really uplifting. You know, I don't want to take too much time, but a little story, it's really cool. When I was working there, you know, I saw there was like this little thing that happened which gave me insight and hope, like more broadly for food and that delicious future I really want. This, a week and a half in, one of the assistant managers was showing me, I'll show you how to make the cookies now. I said, okay. And so she took me, and there's like this special oven, frozen cookies, because everything comes out of the freezer, and like at Burger King. I don't know if people know this, like about our food system in general, like everything comes out of the freezer. So it comes out of the freezer, cookies, you put them in, you hit a button that says cookies. But she had like a little kitchen timer. I'm not even kidding, like a little kitchen timer, and she set it at a different time. And she's like, well, she's like, if you let it do the whole cookie setting, the cookies are sort of hard and they're not really that good. But we take them out, we use this timer instead, and we take them out a little earlier, and they're more gooey and chewy, and customers like them better, and they're a lot more delicious. And I thought, that's amazing. Like, we have somebody at this like Burger King in Winchester, Massachusetts, who's getting paid at the time, you know, $6.15 an hour, and is trying to like go around like the heavily engineered cookie that Burger King corporate wants to make because they think it's a little more tasty, right? It was really cool, and like probably her job's a little bit at risk there, but she was like trying to make something delicious. So I actually had a really good experience there, and it led to buying a food truck. And that's Clementine, and we just put in our first college application last night. So this Clover just hit its 15th birthday. So this is a while ago now, and that's me on the first food truck. And really, you know, we just started out trying to ask people questions. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? Without any preconceptions. Like, we really wanted to know if something, if somebody didn't love something, we don't want them like just nodding and smiling. And it's really hard to get people not, everyone thinks when you ask them, do you like what I made you, that you just want them to say, yes, thank you. But we really wanted to hear what people really thought. So we learned lots of different ways to go about that. And we start out first day with just one sandwich on the menu. And then we came back the second day with a different version of that sandwich. And then we came back the next day with the second sandwich. And then the third day without that sandwich because no one liked it. And we went on like that until we had a core menu. And this looks sort of impossible, like in the post-COVID era, to like imagine this many people in one place. But this is what started happening, and it was a lot of fun, and you know, took on a little life of its own. And then we moved into restaurants, and this, some people might recognize the restaurant that's, when we opened that restaurant, you could actually look over and see the food truck because they were both operating at the same time. And this is another one of our restaurants. This is over at the Harvard Science Center. You know, we continue like developing solutions for the problem. The sandwich, our sweet fritter sandwich, the falafel sandwich, has become Boston's favorite sandwich. And more of this sandwich, you know, we sell more units of this sandwich in Boston every day than any other like sandwich. So you know, it's delicious, but it's also, it happens to be vegan, which is really awesome. A quick plug, you know, I know we're probably getting a little tight on time, but a quick plug for the Brussels sprout sandwich, which just hit. I don't know if anybody had this sandwich before, but this is one of my favorites. And it's, you know, it's a fun example of what we're able to do, because I think that like the future I envision is like people get more and more excited about vegetables. And growing up, like, I love Brussels sprouts. I was a weird kid, but I was like in a cultural environment where people made fun of Brussels sprouts all the time. And it always made me a little bit sad to hear people say bad things about them. And I would sort of be quiet about how much I like Brussels sprouts. And then, you know, a few years ago, I developed the sandwich as like an ode to the Brussels sprout with the hope I could get lots and lots of other Brussels sprout lovers out there. And the neat thing about this is just launched last week on our menu, just timing wise, it happens to be this Brussels sprout season. You have to wait until it's cold at night and a little bit warmer in the day. When this sandwich is on our menu, which is like 5-6 weeks a year, this is the best-selling sandwich we sell, period. So this outsells the chickpea fritter sandwich. It's like, it is our best-selling sandwich we ever have, which is really neat. Now, it doesn't, we don't sell it all year long, but it's really, you know, it's an exciting thing that if you find the right quality of the ingredient and you treat it in the right way, you can like change people's perceptions. So that's all I have to say, you know, really thankful to be invited and part of this, and I'm so happy so many people are thinking about designing solutions for the climate. I mean, this is really an amazing thing. I think we could go back in time only a decade, and we wouldn't find, like, so much energy, you know, and so much effort against such an important problem. So it's really awesome to see, and really thankful for everybody being here.
I'm also a Brussels sprouts person, so it makes me very happy, and I'm excited for the sprouts. So, I'm gonna invite our panelists to come up to the front and take a seat, and you can sit wherever you like, and then I will moderate from there. Thank you. Can you hear? Okay, you can. Yes. Sorry, I'm Heather. So take a breath, and what I'm wanting to do is I'm going to ask two questions in our sort of moderating portion, and you can feel free to answer or not. You don't have to, and you can also build on other people's questions. But I'll start with this one, which is: in your presentations, we saw very different approaches to technology. Some were very tech heavy, and some were less reliant on technology. And in a place like MIT, there's a lot of optimistic confidence about the possibility of technological solutions to climate change. What thoughts do you have on the ways that design and technology might work together in addressing climate and environmental challenges? And you can raise your hand, or I can call them.
I'll go first. I just have a short answer, and that is that
the kinds of information that we're talking about, the data is so complex that design actually becomes really critical in helping people be able to engage with that information, know how it's important to their lives, and that kind of thing. I think if we really want all of the things that we're beginning to understand and know about our world to come to life and help to solve the climate and conservation crises, we need design, right? It's the thing that, it's like the leveler across all these deep areas of expertise across which we can communicate and understand the problem together.
So it's a way to connect to the people, all this information.
Yes.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you.
And make complex information. And even across our areas of expertise, engineering, scientists, that we together, by using design, can help to understand what information.
Yeah, building on what Paul says, I wonder if, everything's being designed, right? It's a question of who's designing and how intentionally and for what parameters. Speaking of food, like the food system we have right now, which we're like all becoming more aware of a lot of the negative outcomes, it was designed like for very specific purposes, which is achieved really, really well. Like, you know, food's never been cheaper, you know? It's very efficient and we get incredible variety. So there are design parameters that were at place, but maybe there are some other things we're missing and maybe not everybody was involved. And I think sort of linking that with technology, there's not a realistic food future in which we go back to how people ate in the 1800s, right? I mean, if you could want that or not want it, it's just not gonna happen. It's not realistic. So I think that we have to, I think where technology can come in is like, as we imagine what kind of future we want and try and start designing solutions to it, like we actually have the ability to build something that's, you know, much better and takes advantage of like where we are in time and what we know. And instead of being nostalgic and thinking back to a time that doesn't really exist anymore.
You mean in terms of production methods or?
I think broadly, you know, I mean, I spent the most time thinking about this for food. I would suspect it applies to other climate solutions as well. I mean, you could say, I think before the internal combustion engine, we weren't belching out all the CO2, but like, is that a realistic way to think about a solution to climate? Is like no internal combustion engine immediately? No, probably not. So maybe we work within what we have or work for substitutes and other things like that. I think for food, this is just very much true. I mean, people used to eat in a very different way. It didn't have a lot of the negative outcomes that the food system does today. But as we think forward, I don't think the solutions are going to be trying to replicate some past food ways. I think instead it's how do you use everything we've developed, all this cool technology and new technologies that are around the corner, and use them to build to new design parameters that make a better food future.
I strongly agree with this as well. I think particularly for food, but really in obviously many kind of climate initiatives, the pastoral imaginary may do more harm than good in a certain way. I guess for me, it's not so much about optimism than it is about realism, in both senses, both in terms of pragmatism, but also in terms of, you know, understanding the world as it is and reorienting ourselves, accordingly to that. Just to piggyback what you said as well, I don't really see it as sort of sociocultural dynamics versus socio-technical, versus technical dynamics. Like the technical is always socio-technical already, and the social is also always socio-technical at the same time. You can't really separate them in different kinds of ways. But to, you know, I'm just to be the technology guy, to be the lawyer on behalf of technology, I suppose. One of the things we've been thinking about lately is simulations and the role of simulations, particularly computational simulations, but not only that as well. And I think it's easy to forget in a certain sense that, as I mentioned, that the phenomenon that we refer to as climate change and the way in which we're all trying to mobilize at different scales and a different tempo as a kind of planetary political response to this, is in response to what is, at the end of the day, a computational simulations of what the year 2050 is going to be like, right? We have predictive models of this future that are calculative, and obviously the variables are mostly social, more than anything else. But you know, we wouldn't normally think of it this way, but what the planetary climate politics is to try to mobilize a response in relationship to this computational system. This places simulations in a position of tremendous political agency, right? And the significance of this, I think, is also important. I guess one thing I wanted to add to this conversation, also around design, is it's important to remember that climate change is not an event, right? It's not something that is going to happen in the future, that is like a Roland Emmerich movie, that Godzilla will show up and this will be the climate change. And it's also not something that will be solved in the sense to which, okay, now we're done. It's forever. It's forever. Like we will, as long as there is, you know, as long as there is sapient intelligence, from this point going forward, the question of how we will compose the planet, how the planet will be made, terraformed, if you like, one way or another, is a permanent condition. And so the question of what viability means, of how it is that we can have that the long-term viability around this as well. Like this is the design question, this is around this as well. And I it's really about the social and technological at the same time. It can't be separate.
I think that makes a lot of sense to sort of think about them. At MIT, we separate them maybe too much sometimes.
Well, in humanities, where I live, they get separated too.
Yes.
With the idea of like, oh, we're not gonna deal with the technology, we're going to deal with signs and symbols, and that will solve it. And that's not, it's a ceremony.
Right.
That's not a response. Yeah.
I fully agree with that. That you really can't separate the social from the technological. But I think too often the technological, especially, we try. And one of the ways my lab is working on this is around the idea of offshore wind co-design. So this is a recent project we've been developing where we're trying to push with a team of engineers the parameters of engineering. And this could go kind of at the base level where you think about the massive offshore wind systems that are being designed across the country, but you know, many being developed now in the Northeast. And you push the design so that it's integrated with community needs and desires and objectives. And you get very different configurations, you get different ideas of what community benefits are, how systems have to operate once you start building a bridge between the technological designers and the system developers and then the communities that are going to be the recipients of that energy. And this can go from something as simple as like the co-design of the system all the way to the technology itself, where right now, you know, the engineering of the technology is done in silos built around the technical criteria. So different ways to understand the wind speeds, the wave conditions, the different vibrations, and how those impact design. They could equally, instead of just thinking about efficiency and in technical criteria, be designed to community concerns. So you could think about even bringing some of the principles of architecture in, where you might have a charrette and you kind of get the designers or the engineers to understand what is it the community needs, what do they want, and then the technology isn't just about optimizing energy produced with wind speed, it's about minimizing impact on the whales and minimizing the impact on the fisheries, and maybe even enhancing the fishery, and you get a very different kind of system or product that is developed out of that interaction.
I love that the message there is similar to what Arrow was saying before, right? So it's thinking about what your stakeholders really desire and how they respond to things. I have another question for the panel. There's a tremendous drive on the part of many students at MIT and other places to engage in climate action, but there's also sometimes a sense of frustration that things are not moving fast enough, and that there are many obstacles that remain, and there's still a lot to do, obviously. So, with all of the things that you each individually do, they're ambitious and they aim to be truly transformative. But what are your thoughts on the speed of change? You know, what would speed or facilitate implementing the work that each of you does?
I can take a crack at that one. So I think this is actually one of the biggest challenges in climate change, is the sense of the need for urgency. and rapid and large scale deployment, it often though leads to poorly considered, poorly developed solutions where you really, for a long-term impact and for a more equitable, just impact, you want deliberation, you want careful consideration, you want solutions to span greater time frames. And so I think that also maybe starts to get at this idea of the ecological and relational tipping point, where we don't want to see a slowness of process as the same thing as inaction. And I think too often there's the sense that if you're being slow and careful, you're not responding to the immediate crisis, but really understanding, as others have said, climate change is going to be a long-term phenomenon, a long-term problem. And so we need to change and adapt our planning processes so we're really accommodating the scale of what's happening and thinking about how our solutions are also going to expand to meet that scale.
I really appreciate that, the sentiment of being thoughtfully considered now and then rather than later, right? And then, but that maybe it isn't as fast as people like. Other comments from?
I mean, I'd say stay impatient. Like, we need, you know, there are a lot of different layers of this. I think that broadly, we don't have the political consensus to, like, drive at this problem as hard as we should. I mean, I think, like, unquestionably, 100 years from now, people are going to look back at this time and scratch their head and be like, what was wrong with everybody? You know, and I think some people are looking at this. So I think that, like, the impatience is great, and put it into action, and, you know, try to use it, that energy, to, like, build more awareness and you know, get more people focused on what we need to do. I think at the same time, there's, like, a lot of optimism I'll share, because Clover just turned 15, so that's a lot of years I've been working on this. It's so much has happened over that time, you know. We're like, I think that there are, I'm looking around right now, we're right in MIT. MIT as an institution is focused on climate change. I mean, we were so far from that, like, back, you know, 15 years ago, it wouldn't be something I would even really conceive of as realistic or an expectation. Where we have, like, lots of capital being directed toward companies that are trying to come up with very serious climate solutions. That was not the case even 5 years ago or 7 years ago. So there are a lot of bright points too. You know, I think that it's great for people to stay impatient. I think the comments that some of these things are going to take a while is probably important too. But there's also a reason for a lot of optimism. I mean, there's maybe not, we haven't made the progress we need to, but there is a lot of movement. We're not standing still. You know, I think we're progressing toward solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I strongly agree with this point. In a certain sense, there's, I guess there's sort of two ways of thinking about it. On the one hand, I think there's a clear sense that there needs to be enough rapid change that the possibility of long-term change is possible. And so that we can change it fast enough so that, you know, those plans can make themselves through. But the deeper significance, I think, of the conceptual realization of Anthropocene, if you want to call it this, has to do with an elongation of the time scales in which we understand who we're really operating in. And so to your question about the students, I suppose, like, what I often will tell them is, it's like whatever you do, whatever you work on, you're working on a climate change project. Like, there is going to have some kind of ecological and climate significance and impact and reverberation. It's not a category of a type of project. It's a fundamental foundation by which any of the kinds of initiatives will work themselves out. But a direct fair answer to your question is, some of the things that I always will you know, tell students is, adaptation is just as important as mitigation in the long run, and particularly in terms of the socio-technical systems that deal with this as well, in this sense. And backwards compatibility, that the most likely, the solutions or interventions that are most likely to have the biggest impact are ones that are able to work with systems that they exist now and are able to reduce the opportunity cost of transition in one way or another. Third, if what you're working on isn't cheap enough to work in India and China, it's not cheap enough, right? It has to sort of work from a kind of really a bottom-up kind of way. Anyway, these are some of the things that you definitely will work.
Well, and I agree. Motivating students to feel like what they're doing in the world is going to make a difference, that their unique passion or peculiar way of looking at things or understanding things well is critical, right, to being able to move these things forward. And when you talk about the impatience, for me, from the world of conservation, we've been caring for a while and earnestly putting out fires here and there, that the key to motivating speed or moving more quickly to a problem that a way of solving this problem is maybe no surprise, for us to have a goal, for us to be able to have something we're looking at together, we want to achieve that we can work together on. And I think that in some sense is the key, so that as we convene to solve a problem like this, that we each feel like in whatever ways we're working, we're able to work together to achieve that goal. I'm really sorry. I think I was there. And it was a dramatic response.
So we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I do want to have an opportunity for people to ask questions. I'm okay. So if people would like to raise your hand, we actually have runners with microphones who can come to you. And in case some online attendees, thank you, are unable to access the live question field, please refresh your browser. Thank you. Sorry, I did not know that.
Hi. Thank you for the great talks. I was wondering on the, you know, there's been some presentations, especially from I'm a climate scientist. I do simulations. It doesn't seem like they do much. We make simulations of like the world's going to do this, and you know, connecting that impact is very hard. How do we go from these big models, big simulations, big data, towards the sort of action that is necessary? How do you make that connection from planetary thinking to doing things?
Should I go first?
Sure.
Okay. That's a tough question, isn't it? The way in which we sort of theorize or sort of think about it is there, we can, that relationship between the predictive simulation and the way it might influence the present, like a prediction of the future in a way that might influence the present. There's certain ways in which this might be, you know, directly recursive or merely reflexive. So the reflexive simulation, we would say, is one in which, I see the implications of that. I'm not going to do this, right? And there's some, it's a kind of negotiation. The recursive simulation is one of maybe a bit more like an actuarial table insurance, where like there's a predictive model of the way in which the future is going to work, and because of the transformation of the predictive model, this directly reprices, let's say, or directly acts back upon the present. Financial simulations do this all the time. McKenzie book about the market is an engine, not a camera, where the prediction of the future is actually producing the present in a kind of retrograde way. So, in the abstract level, we need to think of ways. We need to think of ways in which we can specifically about, well, here's 2050. And here's, the interesting thing here with this, like, you know, if we were having this discussion 25 years ago, we would have something to be we do all this and then we will achieve the future. Now we talk about the future as something to be prevented. The future must be prevented. That's a different kind, that involves a different kind of reaction to this. So as I said, on a reflexive level, it has to do with building of a planetary politics. Ecosystems are planetary by their nature. And arguably the future of politics is the future of climate government. It's climate government, the same thing. And the other is a bit dicier. but interesting. Like, how is it that climate simulations and simulation models of planetary systems might directly and even automatically, cybernetically, affect the things that they're modeling in a kind of direct incursion? What are the infrastructures for that? Carbon pricing is a certain kind of way of thinking about that. In other words, some aspects of it have to do with implications, some of it have to do with like direct instrumentality.
Well, I think you're asking the question, right? I mean, but for all of this work we're doing to try to understand our world better and provide information and data to guide what we need to do to care for our planet, driving that information to action is the key thing we need to do next. And I do think that as we begin to understand, not just model what's happening, but truly know what's happening, truly understand life as it's organized, genes, species, and ecosystems, and really understand how those things fit together to create this web of life that we're part of, that we will have the opportunity to make better decisions to support the future we want to see. And so ways that we're currently driving that kind of information to action is, well, starting early, right? Engaging students at an early age when they have the, when they're open to having those transformative moments where they realize that this is important to themselves and their lives. Working with communities in the places where they live who have their own unique socioeconomic needs or priorities, and helping them to support their lives in those places and using those as models for others to give us courage, right, about how we can manage these things. And I get that it's hard, but as we continue to model that, as we continue to research and understand more about the species of our planet and how they work together to support us, we have to remember they evolved over 3.5 billion years and this exquisite resilience that supports our lives now. And to the extent we don't understand every aspect of it, we have to, with great humility, continue to try to learn more. And with that information, first of all, make sure that we do no harm, and second of all, we can continue to learn and grow.
Wonderful. Appreciate that. Unless you have something, I'm going to see if there's other questions.
Yes. Yeah, I would entertain the idea that at its simplest form, carbon, at least the threshold of carbon that we're talking about, is equal to the levels of which capital is accumulated around the country. So therefore, if I'm, you know, a frequent flyer of American Airlines and I'm achieving gold status, I'm actually contributing to that threshold in that same echoes to the salaries of these people in the rooms as well. I want to think through this framework to think about how income bias in this context actually prevents us to attain some of the more challenging ideas that I think are unthinkable at the moment but are very needed to be also addressed. What do you think about this idea?
So I can take a stab at this one. So a lot of my work, my first book is called The Cultures of Markets. And it's all about the around 2006 to 2014, I was studying the development of emissions markets in the United States and Europe, and as they shifted to other parts of the world. And one of the pieces of this book, what I thought was kind of, I traced the economic theory of pricing and pricing externalities and where that came from Coase's theory through the different inspirations. And as I did that, I started to trace economic theory back more generally, both through the heterodox and orthodox theories. And this led to a realization that the primary way in which we divide value into conceptions of use and exchange are fundamentally spatial. It goes all the way back to Aristotle and the Politics. And there was a neglect of time altogether to the temporality of value. And so if you really want to understand what we're trying to do with externalities pricing, is we're trying to reintegrate temporality into economics. And so to this question of sort of what is climate change, is it a challenge of pricing? No, it's much deeper than that. It's a much deeper spatial temporal phenomenon where the rate at which we're releasing bound carbon from the terrestrial or oceanic reservoirs is much greater than the rate of natural cycling. So if we want to solve this, it's not just about pricing carbon. It's fundamentally about planetary boundaries and how we bring the activities of human, economic, sociopolitical systems back into entrainment, temporal entrainment with natural systems. And to do that, we have to fundamentally reconfigure our economics so that we have some way to generate both a knowledge of the use value, what that means, and externalities aren't actually an extension of exchange value, they're extension of use value. So to stabilize externalities, we need different theories of use, but we also need to entrain temporality into exchange so that we understand the physical, spatial, temporal connotation of what it means to generate and sink a resource, and that's priced within markets, not just this idea that resources across all spatial and temporal connotations can be made commensurate through the price, because they can't. I mean, with like red, for example, you take a forest, an old growth forest, that's taken literally thousands of years to regenerate itself, and you price it as though it exists only in this moment. It's equivalent to something else. Yeah. It's not.
So I think this is a very important point. The temporality of price, particularly price, the temporality of the indexing of value, what price is sort of meant to mean. So negative externalities, as we think about them, are oftentimes things that will happen after the transaction moment. They're in the future for the transaction moment. So going back to the predictive simulation kind of dynamic, how is it, I mean, to the point of how do you fold the externality, the cost of the externality back in, has to be to a certain extent of some kind of model of what's likely to happen after this transaction is done, which was a project that we worked on, probably not successfully. But to Matt's point, more specifically, I think, I mean, this correlation between capital and carbon is clear, and I mean, because both of them have a kind of energy equivalence to them, of capital to energy and energy to carbon. And so part of the answer is like, well, how do you decouple the value from the energy in such a way that you actually are able to produce or protect and preserve value without the energy expenditure on the one hand? But in terms of the bias issue here as well, I think it's well stated that in high energy societies like ours, it's easy to say, well, if we just use less energy, there's a kind of voluntary asceticism that this will sort of get us there. In low energy societies, which is most of the world, that's not viable. A part of the socio-technical transformation here has to be a continuance of development as decoupled as possible in most of the world, particularly in the global south, but not exclusively in the global south. And so how to do so in a sort of way is a tremendous challenge, because obviously the infrastructure we built in the past can't simply be exploited and continued for all these exact reasons.
I think we have a question from Zoom.
A question from the webcast, and this is for Dr. Ehrlich. Is conservation a hopeless effort if demand for products from destructive industries like animal agriculture isn't reduced drastically? Does conserving one area simply shift destruction to another?
No. There are like three questions in there, and I was like, no. I'm an optimist, obviously, and I do think where we are earnestly working to try to conserve more areas, it's not just to the exclusion of everything else we need to do to support life. We need to look at all of those layers of information, population, agriculture, alternative energy. That's another way that we'll be in the future using more and more land for the minerals and other things associated with those technologies. So it's not that one's more important than the other, I don't think. It's that we need to actually do the hard work of pulling together all of that information and understanding what's where and what our priorities are and how we can best support all of life in these places. But I appreciate the question, because there is no real black and white answer, except to the extent that we acknowledge that it's hard, but by understanding more deeply what's needed to support and sustain our livelihoods in these places, that we can come up with ways of supporting.
So I know we have more questions, but I actually, for the sake of time, we're going to wrap things up. And before I bring John back up to close things off, I do want to give our panelists a round of applause.
Well, I'm excited to say we have Clover Food Lab outside.
Yes.
Please join me in at the reception outside where we have Clover food. And for those of you in the online audience, please get back to Cambridge soon to enjoy Clover. And I just want to say overall, it was an inspiring session. And we know one thing is certain, is that we need a thoughtful design to envision the world that we all want to see that works for people and works for all of the other inhabitants of this planet as well. So with that, please join me in thanking all of our participants, also for the workshops.
Thank you. interest issues are around the corner.
I
think it's from all directions.
All directions.
Beverages are around the corner.
Couldn't make it to the workshop.
I thought I registered for
the thing. Oh, interesting. Maybe, I'm also not sure this is supposed to tell you whether you registered or not.
So when I checked in, there were three different types of
clubs. Okay. All right, now I'm glad I missed it. I might not have registered for it.
Yeah, I guess if you don't have a sticker.
Right.
Actually, yours is
yours.
Yeah.
I have a sticker, but yeah. MIT, right, Matt, so like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm currently a student, part-time student at a system design and management, so like engineering management program here. That was sort of how I stumbled into this. They still showed up for this. Still working full time, technically, almost full time. Yeah, I work for Intech at a software company in San Francisco. Yeah, we definitely overlapped, and I was there. I left in like 20 years. Right before COVID, actually. No, I was in North Carolina. That's where I grew up. I kind of been bouncing around. Like, I lived in New York for a little bit, North Carolina for a couple of years. And then when I got into this program, I was like, because I'm working remote, I was like, I went to Boston and spent some time here. Exactly, yeah. Show up for events like this, right? That's kind of the benefit. So are you, you were in the East Bay for 8 years?
East Bay for 8 years. Oh, I was in the Bay for 8 years. I was in East Bay for 4 years.
Oh, okay.
Now I'm in first year at Sloan.
Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah. Are you from the Bay? Or okay.
Oh,
really?
That's where I grew up.
I lived in, there's like a, when I first joined the company, I worked in San Francisco for 6 years, 7 years. When I first joined that company, it was startups in Woodside. They were like in some house.
Oh, really?
In Woodside, yeah. Like right in the middle, right, like right by, yeah, like right by Redwood City, right?
Yeah, yeah, right there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they really are. That's what I've heard. I feel like everyone who grew up or has spent like a long, significant time in California, you hear a lot of that, like, it's nice here, but I'm going back one day.
Yeah, I'm doing my post. I'm gonna have to. Yeah, so
right.
That's what brought me here. Yeah.
Would you post-doc in what? Or like, what was
it?
Oh,
yeah, sorry. I'm in bioengineering. So right now I'm working on engineering yeast, which means mining sites.
Pretty much we sell our machine learning models through APIs, mostly computer vision stuff, so moderation, like violence detection, buzzer detection. The lot of things, like a lot of our models are trained on like television. They'll be like categorizing things that are happening to media solutions. So he works in media companies, a lot of social media companies. That's kind of the core business. But yeah, we've always tried different things. It's one of those kind of environments where now we're into the, and AI, of course, is like space. Better or worse. It's so like a lot of that generative stuff we're doing is kind of like image generation and large language model stuff as well, but it was 2014. Yeah, joined pretty much. Yeah, which is what they were in Woodside. They were at this, like two founders were. There's a castle in Woodside. I mean, they call it a castle. I don't know. It's just a big building that like has rock, you know, like turrets or whatever.
I'll have to know.
Yeah, if you lived in Woodside.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. It's like not far off the highway. Woodside's small, right?
But it's
like,
well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's true. I think like when we moved out to actually like work, like they were there for a year. I joined them in the last sort of 3 months of their lease there. I left IBM, like I worked at IBM for a year and then I went to that. I joined them and then they moved to San Francisco and now normal relatively. But someone else came after, I think they turned it into like a one of those like startup houses, you know, where they like hacker houses, whatever, they have like bunk beds and stuff. And I think the neighbors really said about that. Yeah, I think that's a little stretch if you're like packing in like 30 or 40 people into that.
My mom got a point in Chile.
We're all on the same page, yeah. I have like, I used to think, I don't think layers are enough. I'm like San Francisco, maybe get used to like, okay, you need maybe a jacket. Right. You can't, you like, yeah, it's like, it's going to get windy. You got to make sure you have like something to take off, put on and take off. But now I think it's all about that wind coat. The right. Oh, God, yeah. Oh, good. Dennis. Yeah, you too. What's your name? I'm sorry. Brooke, Dennis. Good to meet you. I'm curious, what was the, remind me, you're saying you're, what is it, you're with yeast that you're doing?
I'm engineering
in mining
site.
So like underground mining.
Yeah, or like brine or things like that. So a lot of mining sites have like that on them.
Sure, okay. I mean, when you say mining, it's not just coal mining.
No, but like metal. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Gotcha, okay. Still, they don't care about that. Chips and like batteries and all the things that, yeah, yeah. It's a kind of hidden side that's not talked about as much as it should be, right? Like the, it's not like a, making things digital is a zero cost.
I have no idea that gold is mined with cyanide or mercury.
Wow, literally picking your poison. Wow. That's crazy. Okay, so you're saying like your theory is that the yeast could be used to like clean up the residual, like sort of after whatever's happening after the writing's done.
Yeah. So you get like the whole community, sexual community,
are there like, is it just theoretical, or is it like, are there companies that are trying to do this?
Oh, no, we're working on that.
Yeah, okay, I was wondering how they
got.
So somehow it's cheaper for the mining, or it may be cheaper even for the mining companies if it's actually for this property rather than. Yeah. But yeah. It's just such an interesting, like, as I learn more about, like, the nooks and crannies of all these different industries, right? Like, in a way, yeah, you can't forget about it. I guess some of these are, you know, some of the folks on the panel are alluding to these too, like, the sort of side effects from everything that's happening. Like, combining for lithium, right? Like, I can't imagine, like, I have no idea what the residuals are that to the communities in those areas. Benefiting from the genetic exposure.
I'm learning. So my PhD was in, I did yeast engineering. So I'm learning so much.
This is your first year here?
Which is really great. I'm learning. It's a lot from the paper.
How many years is it?
Well, to do technical postdocs, I might do like 1 year, like 1 year from now. But I'm going to be here for at least 2 years. Because I don't want to go back.
Yeah, you're not going to mess around?
No, I want to
work
for a company.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. And then you were, well, here or California or like, or anywhere?
We'll see.
Not making no promises. Yeah, I think the MIT environment is interesting. This is also my first year. Being sort of in the community. And, yeah, kind of. 2 years is a good amount of time. It's like, you really want to like expose yourself, see what's happening here, see what the resources are. Like, that's kind of what I'm trying to do, too, showing up to things like this to see what's going on. Like, this Morningside Academy or whatever, like, design. Yeah, I mean, I think it's new. Yeah, I'm, like, curious. I don't know. It's just, like, a random event that I just stumbled into, right? Did you do the workshop earlier?
I did. Okay.
I missed a workshop.
I Okay.
Yeah.
And the Clover guy.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But, it was all like, oh, imagine the future where we have some kind of subsidies for low carbon and we care about taste. We don't care about
taste. Okay. It was like, kind of. Things also, I mean, unfortunately, one of the feelings I get is like, there's a lot happening, but it's like, in a way, it feels kind of unorganized. I don't know, it's like, maybe too simplistic a view, but it's like, there's so many things, people are doing so many things now, at least that's kind of what I'm starting to feel like. Like, how many of these projects are actually mattering? Or like, yeah, like, I don't know, like, Clover Foods, like, what a chance Clover Foods does well. Apparently, they're going bankrupt. Just heard. Yeah. I think they're going to come through it in Chapter 11, but I just heard a couple of which is so funny. I'm going to say, when I went like once, it was great. It's that front end of this philosophy guy too, saying all these like interesting projects and theory.
Oh my god, I will say, when he gave his little presentation,
I was like, that's the, yeah, I get that, like, really, like, I worry about if things feel good, right? Things feel good.
And then they get all the money.
Right.
And then, like, you know, like, for
Harry, at least a, like, a real actor.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's really great for Harry. And so, I mean, you think about, like, wait, I couldn't get out of my friend's house. I couldn't get out of their home. So, I put it down the stairs.
Did you read the napkin? It says, please compost me, essentially. That's pretty much all we got, right, in terms of, like, changing the world. I mean, but, I'm kind of with that. I mean, that, in so many words, I guess, another way of saying is, like, some of this needs to be, like, in my mind, government action.
And you know what?
I've been at MIT like long enough, there's like a lot of people talking about like autonomous vehicles and stuff, and it's like, you know, we're just like making a much easier solution to this, right? Like use transit, like make bicycling easier, like all this, just like simple stuff. There's a little bit of that, like, yeah, engineering bottom up solutions are like, they sound good, but yeah, like it's much harder to get everybody to some sort of, to like, to beat McDonald's, like by having a bunch of startup restaurants somehow beat McDonald's like at their game. Can I join you? Of course, please. But yeah, so yeah, I worry that there's a little short-sightedness now, or at least just like a lot of these things are not going to be, like in 10 years or 20 years, if like we get legislation passed, it should nullify a lot of the need for so many of these efforts. But I don't know.
There's no plastic
bag. Right. I'm from North Carolina, so.
Yeah, so you have. Yeah. It was funny moving there with, like,
the bag. Yeah, from California. It definitely is.
Well, so I lived in California growing up. Then I moved to my undergrad school.
Where? Edinburgh?
Edinburgh, yeah. And then I did my master's in London. Okay. And then I went to Georgia. It was, like, a culture shock.
Yeah. Trending one way.
Yeah, I know.
That's a pretty up and down, yeah. Where in London?
I was at Imperial
College
London,
okay.
So
cool. I studied abroad in UCL. Right? So yeah, I spent some time there. It's lovely. So many people. Hitting the highlights, that's all we have. I'm quite happy to have come here, so I'm glad you've been here.
What are you doing? Are you both students here, or are you
Yeah, that's a good question.
felt like you needed 6 months to learn to love San Francisco.
And I think after a while, you can really learn to love it. And I mean, maybe many most things are like this, but I definitely love San Francisco. I do love San Francisco. I like it a lot. But yeah, I think it's gotten only harder. You know? It really is like... Yeah, I think you have to pick a neighborhood that you know people and you have, like... Yeah, like, in a way, your community, I think, needs to have already been built out for you. I don't think, like, in New York, at least in my experience there, at least it's, like, there's a dynamism where, like, people are, like, out and about. There's sort of a lot of people, right? San Francisco is actually kind of a small city. Once you remove, like, if it's just the people who are working there during the day.
Yeah.
And then, like, because that's the problem. Is like Boston. That Boston, a little bit. I mean, some neighbors in Boston felt that, like, downtown Boston, like, not really active in a sort of way for a young person if that was your son, like, I don't know, maybe even like South Bay or East Bay, like maybe there's like pockets right there. So I have a friend who lives, like a couple friends who started living myself, and like the one who lives like out in the kind of boonies, he's still there and happy. He has his little community, has his like coffee shop and movie theater and all that stuff, but it's almost like a small town life in San Francisco, right? Which is just sort of interesting. LA, of course, is a whole different ball game. My brother lives in San Diego, so it's a great city. San Diego's a great city. It's a treat. San Diego's like, that's maybe the California dream almost.
Yeah, it's like relaxed,
it's not like so sprawling like LA.
Software
guy.
There's an experience that everybody has to have.
Yeah, yeah.
Opening this can, designing the can, finding any some physical or any service. It's all sort of rigid. Does this person want to get done? What are their emotions around it? What are they? How do they think about it cognitively? And then designing the thing so it delivers something that really easily fits with their sensibility.
Are you working with the Morningside Academy, or are they
new?
They're kind of new, right?
They're brand new. Yeah. Well, they're somewhat new. I've been hearing about them, and of course, I've known, like, somehow connect them with the building that they're going to move into, which has been in the target of MIT. Like, what are you going to do with that building for like 30 years? I remember one of my fraternity brothers was an architect, and they were working on what to do with that building 30 years ago.
It's a like, giant brick building that's missing. I
haven't seen what Trump's missing, but it says like fireproof warehouse.
Yeah, that's right.
Metropolitan. Yeah. So that's it's huge. It's huge and long and skinny and tall.
That's all
it's like a castle. So this is my first event he's building a graduate course in product design, a one-year product design degree. And it's like,
do you mind if I send you up?
I don't come back here very often. So you live in the area? Are you lucky? Okay. Uptown. Gotcha. This was all sort of
down. It's just down Main Street.
I pass it through.
Yeah.
It's two doors down from here.
Yes. We just don't think it's the paper.
You think what?
We don't think it's the paper.
Yeah, yeah. The name is the only problem.
Exactly.
K-I.
Yeah, when I
sent the post out here, my PI
got
ready
to check, like,
you
know what building we're going
to, like,
yes, Lauren,
we'll
talk about it.
Yeah, it's like something a little, yeah.
That's taken up.
Yes.
All about you sorting.
They also, so bioengineering generally is in there as well, or is just
no,
your
only concern? It's an interdisciplinary building focused on cancer, just that my lab is like half cancer, half bioengineering. Bioengineering is in a few different buildings. There are people in like Tech Square, Brain of Care
name.
Yeah. Like, what even is bioengineering? My PhD is in biochemistry.
Biochemistry,
biotech, bioengineering, they all share.
I remember there's a biomedical engineering as well. You had like three disciplines in there, you have four disciplines.
Well, it's an interdisciplinary discipline.
Yeah.
It's a non-interdisciplinary discipline.
I mean, that's kind of the theme of all this too, right? You're saying like there's a the mechanical engineering is also doing a design, because I'm in system design and management, which is like half Sloan, half engineering, in theory. And they have another sort of sister sibling program that's integrated design system or something like IDS, and that's moving into Morningside. All this sort of like
design is really an activity.
It's kind of a horizontal along.
Well,
line.
It's an activity. There's mechanical design, there's industrial design, there's biological design. Exactly. It's like writing.
Yeah.
So design is a synthesizing rather than analyzing activity. So
that's good. That's
so. Design is an integrated and a multidisciplinary. Most things today have to be multidisciplinary. They don't have any complexity to it. So it's cool to have different disciplines on the team, but it's also cool to have people who span the discipline. It's all the tension that you need is great.
Yes.
Have you taken classes from Steve Eppinger?
Not from Eppinger. He's on our tech team. No, the core class is the only one I'm taking right now. That's just, right now it's Brian Moser. Eric Reventish and Bruce Cameron, Ed Crawley, those are the ones. Crawley's, he's kind of an old timer.
Yeah, that made me very familiar. Steve Eppinger is
he's an aero astro at Crawley.
Crawley? Yeah. Eppinger is an old mechanical engineer.
Yeah, he's referenced a lot. I think, does he still teach? I don't even know.
Teach here?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't even know if he did.
All right, we'll keep up the good work.
Thank you. What was your name?
Dave
Weisberg. Dave. Good to meet you. Dennis.
Dennis?
Yeah. Bro.
Good to meet you all.
Oh my God.
Will you join us this evening?
Thank you too. You're like, there's a little bit of compost. See, they're confusing us with the food.
It says no compost.
Oh, that doesn't say compost. It says food.
Yeah, I know. MIT is weird. They like won't allow compost. Which, like,
it's kind of a pleasure. Is there something specific about it?
I look, I'm a pictorial person because the words don't mean enough.
There you go. Design and action.
It's a total interface.
Right? Yeah, it totally is, yeah. And like how much friction is there, right?
In the step.
Good to meet you, bro.
No, nice to meet you.
Maybe I'll find you on LinkedIn.
Yeah, come on there.
I was thinking about if I have... just in case if I have connections in East shepherding. No, just kidding.
Also, I'd honestly love to learn more about the stuff offered in management.
Oh, yeah,
because,
sure.
Because like, I want to move more from actual science to...
Maybe you can find yourself.
Yeah. So
yeah,
I've been trying to think about those things.
There is like...
What keyboard is this?
Oh, no. Did I change it?
Yeah, you did. It's fine.
It's probably Turkish.
Do you speak that?
My family's Turkish, yeah, so I
never know how to add somebody versus just follow.
You just do the
connect. Part, there we go. I'm not very good at technology.
No, that's all
right. Right now I'm trying to, like, redesign our team using this software called Rosetta, and it's, like, in Python.
Oh,
it's like I've been using ChatGPT. I'm like, I get this error message. What
do
I
do back? And code. Everyone has to deal with it now. I guess it is bioengineering.
I know. My PI keeps saying, can I have you do a machine learning fellowship? I'm like, no, Angie, I can't code. And she's like, oh, because redesigning a protein count is machine learning. I'm like, no, Angie.
That's so funny.
I can't code.
Redesigning the protein of machine learning.
Yeah. Yes.
Hold on, there's more. There's more.
Is there more? I was thinking maybe I'll have a takeaway.
There is more.
Olive oil sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, I've never tried the olive oil.
May I?
Yeah, go for it. Take two.
Alright, I'll take one.
The boxes over there. Like,
yeah, you're right. We want to do our part, right?
You're literally just helping.
Yes, sir. You know what? I don't want to. What do they call it?
Never making
food.
Avoid food like this. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's delicious.
Yeah, who does that? I haven't tried this Brussels sprout sandwich.
Oh my God, I really want to try it.
I do want to try it.
Yeah.
They were talking about it.
It's very, very creamy, crispy.
I love Brussels.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. It's all
right. Oh, I love that. And it, yeah.
The weirdest but the best part is the hazelnuts.
Interesting.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
So man, I need to.
The last bite, the last little hint is the hazelnut. That's what happens.
See, this is like a. Clover's definitely making back whatever they put in.
Yeah.
Like the free ads, good advertising.
Yeah, I'll have to stop by sometime.
You know, right across the street.
Yeah, right there.
It's too close to where I work.
Oh, yeah, that's close.
So, I feel like there's
a I'm going to do a little second round.
Yes. Yeah.
No, let me try that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's okay. You enjoy them. I've had Impossible Meatballs before. Are they?
They just taste like.
Well, Impossible is good. It's okay. This way I don't stick to the hummus paste. All right, give me a try. I'll let you know if I think
about
it. Yeah, let me know if you're ever thinking about Sloan too.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. Oh yeah, are you able to take classes still? Well, they're definitely like workshops.
But at least, it's easy to try.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, my surrounding as well, you're right.
Consolidation.
Falafel that's made to be.
No, sorry, I have to clean up the falafel.
Well done.
Yeah.
Someone had to do it.
Yeah.
I was
just trying to help.
I was too shy.
Okay, good.
So I left you whatever.
I knew there was courage.
Yeah,
required.
Yeah.
Second drink? Do the winter lager again, please. That was good.
See, that's a check.
If you can't do that, no more, right? Yeah, that's your last one, right?
Maybe you're not having a second.
Yeah, yeah. How long does it take to pick a cup up? Sack? Yeah. Thank you.
I know, it's not exactly.
So, I've written with them to compete. So, I want to be competitive. And we're launching a new launching for the top champions. But we're having a new launch. And my VP called about and VP preparation. Both one that I think is back to the for muscle. She didn't know it was going to happen. So, we are like, playing catch up on the like, it just was a nightmare. Like, I got a very tiny.